Welcome to Under the Fig Tree podcast with hosts Reverend Dr. Ben Haupt and Reverend Micah Glenn. In today's episode, Ben and Micah sit down with a special guest as they meditate under the fig tree.
What's up, and welcome back, everybody, once again to another episode of Under the Fig Tree. I am your host, Reverend Micah Glenn, the Director of Recruitment here at Concordia Seminary, and of course, joined by my highly esteemed co-host, Reverend Dr. Ben Haupt. How are you doing today, bro?
I'm well. It's nice to be back recording another episode. It's been a few days since we recorded, and I'm really excited about what we're going to talk about today.
Yeah, so if you have been listening to us since season one, towards the end of last season, you know, we were talking about church work, but we took a break to talk about the Bible, because that's maybe the main topic of study here at the seminary. So today will be the first of a series of episodes on parables. And to bring us into that topic, we do, in fact, have a special guest with us, Ben. You're not the special guest.
Special, but not the special guest.
Right.
Thank you. Yes, I agree with that. So we have with us today Dr. Jeffrey Gibbs. Dr. Gibbs and his wife, Renee, had a wonderful ministry and service to our church and to the student body here at Concordia Seminary for, I believe, over 30 years. And
28 years.
That's amazing. Dr. Gibbs was my teacher when I was at the seminary from 2000 to 2005. He was also Micah's teacher when Micah was here.
2011 to 2016.
Yeah. Dr. Gibbs is an emeritus professor of Concordia Seminary and the author of a couple of volumes. His dissertation is published and is really helpful if you ever want to dig into end times and what Matthew has to say about end times and Jesus' return and the prediction of end times as Jesus talks about the temple. But he is probably most well known for his Concordia commentary on the Gospel of Matthew. So Dr. Gibbs, we are excited to have you with us today.
Thank you, Ben and Micah. It's a great pleasure and happiness for me to be here.
Before we get into parables, something we like to do is to ask a quick question, and feel free to answer any way you want. What led you to pursue ministry as a career? Before teaching, because now they know you were a teacher for a very, very, very long time, almost as long as I've been alive.
Very nice.
My back feels just fine.
I have to remind our hearers. What did you do before becoming a professor? I mean, The assumption is that you were a pastor of some sort.
Yes.
So those two questions, what led you to pursue ministry, and then what was it like at the very beginning?
Well, the path to ministry for me is kind of a great example of the way I seem to have lived basically my whole life. And that is something is placed in front of me. I didn't ask for it. I didn't plan it. And then I think, oh, that might be something that God would want me to do. And so then away I go. So I was a college student. I had gone to college thinking that perhaps I might want to be a teacher, a mathematics teacher, actually. And when I hit upper level calculus, I realized that probably wasn't going to happen. But then college is a crisis for a lot of people. It was for me, spiritual crisis. And then looking back, especially God showed himself to be faithful, answering my prayers, protecting me in a number of not too dramatic ways, but looking back. And it was during that time that I thought, well, maybe I should serve him. Mm-hmm. I hadn't actually asked that question for the first 19 years of my life. And I tell you this, guys, it was the example of my congregation, my home pastor, who his example and his joy in the ministry almost made it automatic that I would consider the ministry. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote to Concordia Theological Seminary in Springfield, which is where our sister seminary was located at the time. And they wrote back and said, great, stay where you're at. I happen to be at Rice University in Houston.
All right.
And I got a history degree there, and I took kind of a variety of liberal arts courses and then studied Greek as well. And then off I went. And then in 1979, Renee and I were married already in college. And so I took a call to a parish ministry, to a dual parish in northwestern Oregon. Mm-hmm. And so we stayed there for 10 years in that congregational ministry, which was a very, very key formation time for me. I'd like to think that that formation never left me. I don't think it did. So we served there, and that was really challenging and frightening and wonderful and satisfying, mostly satisfying. I remember thinking so often that what I did as a pastor was, first of all, it was kind of beyond me, but then thinking, man, this is really significant.
Yeah.
You know, you guys know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, for sure.
So, and then at the encouragement of other people, I actually, as it was called, took a peaceful release. I resigned from the congregation and went back to doctoral studies. So we actually traveled from near Portland, Oregon to Richmond, Virginia, which is fairly far. We could have gone to Bangor, Maine, or maybe Key West, Florida.
I was going to say Miami or something
yeah,
like that.
Right. Yeah, right. And I was there in graduate studies for 3 years, and then I was called here in 1992, and then taught New Testament here for 28 years. I retired in summer of 2020.
And like a good professor, pastor, you're retired, but you still, on occasion, teach and do pastoral things.
Yeah, yeah. I'll be honest, I was very tired when I retired.
Sure.
But the department has been kind enough to say, hey, would you teach a course in this or this? And so at the present, I'm teaching one course a year, which feels good to me. And there are other things like hanging out with guys like you.
Sure.
And you may retire from a particular vocation, but you don't retire from discipleship.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So. Jeff, I want to ask a little bit a follow-up. So your time on the West Coast as a pastor, your time on the East Coast as a graduate student, you have some particular insight into the coasts of our country, which is not where most LCMS Lutherans live, right?
Right.
But we know that we have some listeners who are out on the coasts, mm-hmm. And we have some listeners that I think have a particular heart for people who live on the coasts and maybe aren't your typical certainly the people that are living around the coasts aren't typical LCMS folks.
Right.
So what was that like, and what does it look like to be a faithful witness in a place that is, really in this post-Christendom kind of secular environment?
Yeah, that's a good question, Ben. Before I say anything, you know, my experience is anecdotal.
Sure.
It's just what I happen to bump into and see. And I will also say that parish ministry in essentially the 1980s, to be a pastor then, is pretty different than what it is to be a pastor 40 years later.
Sure.
Nevertheless, I would describe, and we live in a small town in Oregon, I would describe the context as sort of cheerfully unchurched. Hmm. You know, in the Midwest, or Texas, Renee and I are kind of from Texas, if you didn't go to church, you kind of didn't admit it.
Right.
You know? But I still remember we moved into a parsonage there in our little town in Oregon, and the very pleasant neighbor woman brought cookies over, and Renee naively asked her where she went to church. And she said, oh, I don't go to church, you know, and it was just as natural as the day is long, you know. So, and again, I actually, I don't know why, because I'm not the boldest guy in the universe, right? Again, give me a cup of coffee and a book and leave me alone. I'm kind of an introvert. So if we have any introverts listening, guess what? We need pastors who are also introverts, right?
Amen. For sure.
Yeah, there's not one personality type.
That want to be in your face all the
time. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. God uses all personalities. it was refreshing in a way because people weren't pretending, you know, and sometimes people wanted to know. And it and so it, it made me realize the importance of the connections that the members of the congregation had with the community. Right. So if they talked to me, I was a weird guy because I was a pastor. What was that? You know, but if they taught at the local elementary school with a friend who was a member of the church and the friend showed herself or himself to be a loving, caring person. And, oh, hey, why don't you come to church or bring your kids to Vacation Bible School or whatever it was. So so in that sense, it was kind of refreshingly honest. It was one funny experience is I had a membership class, you know, about a year in. And I had, as I recall, I had 12 adults. I could be getting these numbers a little bit off. And it occurred to me about halfway through the class to ask these adults if they had ever been baptized. And seven had never been baptized.
Wow.
Right.
And so in our little church there, when this, this, I think all those members of the class joined the congregation, we had to take out a pew in the front to fit all the catechumens who were being baptized, which is very exciting, right?
Wow.
But it's a little church. So it was not a big size. So that was West Coast as a pastor. On the East Coast, it was a little different because I was a graduate student. I was keeping my nose to the grindstone. But I will say it was good for me to attend graduate studies at Union Theological Seminary in Virginia, not Union in New York. There's no connection. Because there I kind of came up face against people who were very different than I was and very different than I am. And so I was forced to A, interact with ideas that I didn't initially understand. And then I later, when I did understand them, I disagreed with them.
Sure.
See, nevertheless, I had to interact and understand and treat other people with respect who were very different.
Yeah.
And I'll have to say that the program there was very fair-minded. They didn't care in a sense whether you agreed with them. They just wanted you to do your work and show that you could. And so our experience there was very difficult, challenging in some ways, emotionally, especially because we left this congregation that we loved and they loved us very, very well. So, but it was a kind of a different sort of what's the coast like. But, it, you know, again, God brought us through and he preserves us. And yeah, when we got to St. Louis, we thought, and I'll, I hope that don't hurt anybody's feelings, you can't swing a dead cat around here without hitting a Missouri Synod Lutheran, you know?
Right.
Which is a good thing, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it certainly was not like that anywhere we had ever lived except for Springfield, right, where there's also a lot of Lutherans.
When when people come from out of town for seminary or for a call, and if we happen to be friends and we meet up, I try to explain to them that St. Louis is, for all intent and purpose, for the LCMS, it's kind of like Rome.
Yeah, it is, right.
It's the place that you go if you're a Lutheran at some point in time for a pilgrimage or whatever. But yeah, I mean, but it does, it changes the dynamic of what it means to be, in particular, LCMS Lutheran in this space, you know, for one way or the other.
Our little town had a newspaper called the Scappoose Spotlight. It came out once a week, and they had an article when I was installed in the congregation there, and they misspelled the name Lutheran. L-U-T-H-R-A-N, Lutheran. And I don't think they misspelled Methodist. But see, nobody quite, it was a little church, a little town. They didn't really know anything about Lutheranism.
Yeah, yeah.
So
when,
anyway.
When I was a pastor in Georgia, they told me that they loved the television commercials that my church body had been putting out. And I thought to myself, I don't know what they're talking about, but I think it's been a really long time since the LCMS had television commercials on mainstream television. I was thinking, and I was just kind of, I gave them that, I don't quite know what you're talking about look. And they said, well, you know, those commercials that say, I'm a Mormon.
I
said, oh, okay. I said, that's actually not our church body. Different group, and they have some different beliefs than we do. I tried to be, you know, winsome.
Just
and,
a little.
That's and I said, no, that's LDS, and we're LCMS.
Got it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So anyway. In the coasts where, you know, nobody knows what a Lutheran is. It's kind of fun to be, because
it can be. It can also be very difficult.
Right. Yeah, that's right. A little isolated.
So anyway, that was our experience.
This doesn't have to do with being a pastor at all. But first, I didn't know that you studied at Rice. And at a different time in Rice's history, there's this wonderful molecule that was discovered there called Buckminster Fullerene.
Uh-huh, yeah.
I did a whole paper on it when I was in chemistry.
Rice was a serious, high-powered place.
Yeah. One of my professors at Concordia Chicago, she was there when they discovered, well, they call it the Buckyball. And of course, they weren't trying to discover it. They were trying to discover space proteins. But nonetheless, her team was working on diamond coating metal.
Oh, interesting.
And to do that, you vaporize carbon. And the entire time they were doing that, they had been creating Buckminster Fullerene. They just weren't looking for it. So imagine that. Has nothing to do with anything. I just studied chemistry. And when you said rice, that's what triggered.
I'm just thinking of the phrase geodesic dome now.
Yeah. I mean, anyway, let's not get derailed by my meanderings into Buckminster Fullerene. Because today we're talking about parables.
Great.
A literary device that has been used for a very long time, that we still have modern parables that people use. In fact, I was preaching over the weekend, and I used what I thought was a modern parable. It's like the guy trapped in a flood who ignores the log, the boat, and the helicopter and dies and says, you know, why didn't you save me? It's like, well, I sent these things to save you. Also, it's like a story, right?
Right.
Can be metaphorical or whatever. But within this metaphorical story, there's some pointing towards an important truth.
Right.
And this is something that's used throughout scripture in a variety of different ways.
Right, right.
Can I say the phrase that needs to be said just to kind of get it out of the way? It's the earthly story with the heavenly meaning, right?
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that's not completely wrong. Micah, your comment that other people have used things that we would call parables is quite right. It's just a way that humans communicate.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it has the advantage of being kind of indirect. So, you know, when you hear a parable, depending on how your brain works, you either look up to the right or to the left because you're trying to figure out what this means, right? And that's probably part, at least, of the reason why Jesus in his ministry used so many parables.
Of course. And thinking about it, the first one that I can really think of biblically, at least chronologically, how it's laid out for us, is the prophet Nathan.
Yes.
But I wonder, these two smarter gentlemen across from me might be able to tell me if there are earlier parables than that.
That's the first one that comes to mind for me as well.
Okay. And of course, he's talking to David, and he talks about, what is it, a rich man who steals the sheep and kills the guy.
Right.
And then David's like, who is this man? He should be put to death.
Right.
And you get that famous, Ata Ha'ish, you're the man?
You are the man. Yeah. Right.
And that's the thing. Like, right, it's this story. And like, depending on how your brain is working, you can pick up kind of the motion of the parable.
Right.
But maybe not the point that's being made
right
away.
Right.
And it can set you up one way or the other. And Jesus does do this sometimes as well.
Right, right. Yeah, and it's interesting if you look at the New Testament, a parable is just something that's thrown next to another thing.
Right.
And so if you just look for that word in your English Bible, for instance, parable, what you're going to find is that sometimes a parable is something like what we would call a riddle, right? But other times it's something well known like the parable of the Good Samaritan, which is kind of this fairly lengthy story, and it's got plot development and drama and all those kinds of things. So I think it's important to say that there is no one definition of a parable. It's just kind of a comparison of some sort. But I really like your way of saying it, Micah, that normally we think of it as kind of a symbolic story.
Right.
It could be a very, it can be one sentence long.
Can be.
Like the parable of the hidden treasure, for instance, is one sentence.
Oh, yeah.
See, but it embodies a little narrative, a little story. And then, especially with Jesus' parables about the kingdom or about the reign of God, right? There, there's always something unexpected about it. Mm-hmm. Not so much. Our friend and my senior colleague, Jim Vels, has made an important distinction, I think, that actually works a lot of the time. He talks about kingdom or reign of God parables, and he calls them piety parables, like the parable of the rich fool,
right?
About the guy who has a lot of stuff. He tears down his barns, he builds more barns, and then God says, fool, which is the kind of thing you don't want God to say to you. Tonight your life is required of you, you know. The piety parables are a little bit obvious, right? Like when in that parable, for instance, which is in Luke 12, I think, there's a character in that story, and the character is God. Now, who does God stand for in the parable? God. But some of the other parables are not at all obvious, like the parable where Jesus talks about the wheat sown in the field and an enemy sows weeds.
Yeah. You
know? I don't know if you've ever noticed how much Jesus, he kind of decodes everything at the end. The weeds are this, the weeds are this, the enemy is this, the harvest is this. And so the reign of God parables are often more complex, and they are surprising, which should not surprise us, because guess what? When Jesus shows up to be the king, he doesn't do it in ways that we think are normal.
Right.
And I think that's a beautiful thing about the parables. It's always, the reign of God or the kingdom parables always look for something unexpected. Like the sower went out to sow and he threw seed on the path. So, okay, check it out. Ancient Near Eastern farmers are not stupid. They don't say, oh, there's a path. I'm going to throw seed on that. No, not at all. There's some rocks sticking up. I'm going to sow seed on the rocks. No, but see, that's the point, is that Jesus in his ministry is what we might call wasteful. He's extravagant, right? And he sows seed everywhere. And guess what? Most of it never comes up and bears fruit. Ah, but when it does, now it's 100-fold, 60-fold, 30, I think, is the other number. So that to me is a helpful distinction. And sometimes it's hard to tell. And again, you can't be too precise. But a lot of Jesus' parables in Matthew, Mark, and Luke are reign of God parables, a lot of them. Mm. Luke, I think, is the only one who has these piety parables. Gospel of John, oddly enough, in this sense of symbolic stories, has zero parables.
Unless you include the Gospel of John as a symbolic story. But
well, okay, that's another important and very provocative question. Fair. So you're going to have Dr. Bruce Schuchart here next time, right?
Right.
He can do John. Yeah, that's
right. Again, not a parable, has nothing to do with nothing, but at the seminary, so if studying theology wasn't enough, we have opportunities to study abroad.
Yeah.
And I took advantage of one and studied at Westfield House in Cambridge, England. I took the Gospel of John along with Catholic epistles when I was there. And this might surprise you, it was not a Lutheran approach to God's word, especially at the faculty in Cambridge.
Sure.
And so I struggled a lot with learning John's theology there, because the way the lecturer proposed it was in a year-long series of questions about the text.
Yeah.
That if you raised your hand for an answer, never got the answer that you expected, but also in a level of thinking that we maybe weren't at when we were learning it. But again, maybe she was being parabolic, maybe not.
It's possible.
It seems like that. But that's interesting. And I, you know, of course, I'll be honest, I don't sit around and think about the parables biblically 24 hours a day. Mm-hmm. Usually when it comes up in a text I'm about to preach on, that's when I'm like, what is this parable saying? But back to the parable, the sower, because we've brought up some things where it could be applicable.
Yes.
Right, because you're right. Ancient farmer wouldn't just throw his seed, which would have been valuable.
Seed is expensive.
Right? Even if you harvest your own, which is probably what they had to do back then, but each seed you're hoping produces another fruit down the road. And so, you're not going to intentionally throw it on the road or amongst rocks where you know it's not going to grow.
Right.
and we were talking about Lutheranism, we kind of have this heartland of Lutheranism in the Midwest, because this is where our church body landed.
Sure.
And of course,
historic reasons, all that. Every denomination has these.
And so when you're out on a coast, maybe in a little town of Portland where people aren't necessarily so inclined to Christianity or, you know, openly not Christians, you know, you ask, the question will be asked, is it worth having a church there?
Right.
According to the parable of the sower, right?
Right. The efficient American answer would be, no, it's not worth it.
Right.
I'll dare to speak for the Lord Jesus here. Jesus's answer is, you're darn tootin', it's worth it. Is that okay to say on the radio?
Oh,
you're darn tootin'. Yeah. I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings.
It's an official quote. It's a different version, but...
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So the parables are actually an invitation to... again, especially the ones that are concerned what it looks like when God comes into the world to be king in Jesus, right? So what is that like? And it's like a king who had a bunch of servants and he decided to settle accounts with them, right? And you know what? One servant was called and he owed his master 10,000 talents. Now, a talent, there's a gold talent and a silver talent. I'm sorry, I know this stuff, right? A silver talent is 6,000 days' wages. So that's 20-something years. A gold talent is 10,000 days' wages. That's 30. Anyway, do the math, right?
Right.
And he owes 10,000 of those. And he says, this is unbelievable, be patient with me and I'll repay you. What? The master had compassion on him. And he forgave him the debt. And then he goes out and finds a servant who owes him 100 days' wages, which normally would be a big debt, right?
Right.
But in the reign of God, that's not a big debt. Again, see, when you look for that exaggerated element in Jesus' parables about the reign of God or about the kingdom, most of the time, guess who shines out more brightly than you even expected? Jesus, right? It's the Jesus answer. And it's very beautiful. And sometimes people like that idea, and sometimes it makes them want to kill Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Imagine
that.
And that's what I wanted to ask about. So sometimes I hear people talk about the parables and they say, well, Jesus used parables because he's a great teacher. Mm-hmm. And great teachers use parables to make a special point and to get their point across. I guess I had that idea. Mm-hmm. And then you come across this place in, is it Matthew 13?
Mark 4.
The disciples ask Jesus, so why are you teaching everything in parables? Because I think nobody was understanding what Jesus was talking about.
Right.
And the disciples clearly aren't in the text understanding what Jesus is talking about. So it's not a great pedagogy tool. It's not a great teacher's tool. And Jesus says, I'm speaking in parables so they don't understand.
Right, right.
So I don't understand.
You're absolutely right, Ben. And to say, for instance, Jesus taught in parables, we should teach in parables, is wrong on a number of levels.
Right.
It's not that you can't ever use a symbolic story, a sermon illustration or something like that. Of course you can. But both in Matthew and Mark, it actually says this. And check it out. Imagine this, we should read the Bible and pay attention to what's going on around that passage, that verse, in other words, in the context. Guess what? People have been rising up against Jesus and rejecting him. Mm. Just to pick Matthew, which I know a little bit better than Mark, in chapter 12, they accused Jesus of casting out demons by the power of the devil, see? And then Jesus' own family wants nothing to do with him, right? So guess what? Jesus tells the parables, at least as you read Matthew and Mark, in response to people not getting it. And so he stops giving the goods straight, and he gives them indirectly. Doesn't mean they don't understand, necessarily. So that seeing they may not see, that's what it says. Now, two things there. One is he's still reaching out to his audience. If he didn't want to reach out to them, he wouldn't talk to them. Mm-hmm. But this is where that indirect indirect method of communication, I think, actually comes to the fore. So why do I tell you that kind of a phony or funky story in my sermon? Because I don't want you to get it at first. I really don't. I want you to be troubled by this story and to chew on it, right? And so I do think that that's a good example of how, now when I'm teaching, in general, I don't want to be misunderstood,
right?
Right? Or I don't want to hide things. But it's even possible there that if you want to give somebody just a little bit of God's good news or just a little bit of the truth that you might prayerfully think is appropriate at the moment, you don't back up the whole truck and dump it on them, right? You just give them a little teaser and then you look for more opportunities. So even in our lives, it's possible that we might do that. But in a sermon, no way. Say, only to illustrate a point that's kind of already known. And that's the way rabbis, apparently other rabbis in Jesus' day and afterwards taught in parables too, that's the way their parables function. They make a common point and then they tell a story to illustrate the point that they just made. Jesus just tells parables. And sometimes people get it, sometimes they don't. Sometimes they get it and they believe him all the more. Sometimes they get it and they hate him all the more. So it is, it's an interesting, especially when it's his enemies, right? They understand what he's saying and it makes them hate him and his message all the more, which speaks about human sin.
But then graciously, he takes his disciples aside and says, psst, let me, well, they ask him, right? They want to know what this parable is. So we're like, what are we talking about?
He interprets it for them.
That's right. The disciples are always dense in the Gospels, right? Right.
Yeah, well, they only seem to put the pieces together kind of the way we do after the story of his ministry is complete, right?
Yeah.
Good Friday and Easter. He is risen indeed, right? And only then do they really put the pieces together. And you see this actually in the book of Acts.
Yeah.
You know, in Luke, the disciples are kind of clueless much of the time. In the upper room, they're fighting about who's the greatest.
What? For the second time, right?
Exactly. But then in Acts, Jesus spends 40 days with a serious Bible study with the disciples, teaching them about, guess what? Luke says, the kingdom of God. Mm. Then the Holy Spirit comes on them at Pentecost, and now they're still flawed and they're still sinful.
Of course.
But do they get it? Yes, they do, in a way that they could not get it before the end and culmination of Jesus' ministry had happened. Yeah. Right? Yeah.
And so there, so Matthew is retelling his hearers when he's writing his gospel. He's kind of slowly taking them through the story of how the story of Jesus is unfolding.
And we have that privileged position, as all the readers of the Gospels do, of knowing there's no spoiler alert. You're supposed to know, right, how the story ends. And we, and yet that's a beautiful thing about the Lord's teaching, is that a lot of times it probably wasn't activated, if I could use that word, in the disciples' lives at all, really. But after, John's gospel actually says this twice, I think, after Jesus was raised from the dead, then they remembered, right? And so in that sense, we shouldn't be too hard on the disciples. They were still his disciples. He still chose them. He still loved them. But they're kind of, I like to say when the disciples approach Jesus and ask a question, you should cue the theme music from The Monkees. You guys remember that TV show? Right.
Sorry.
Anyway, I just dated myself there, so you can. It's on YouTube.
Got it.
Yeah, that's right.
Now I'm ready.
So, but yeah, again, that's the beautiful thing. Like, I like the parable of the workers in the vineyard in Matthew 20, where you know how the story goes: a master hires workers for the vineyard, and so at the first hour he hires them and says, "I'll pay you whatever's right," and they say, "Okay, great." So he goes out every so often, he hires more workers. Goes out at 5 in the afternoon, you know, the 11th hour, and hires more workers. Now here's a middle-class Missouri Synod mistake, if I can just say that. He says, why have you not, why are you sitting here idle in the marketplace? And they say, because nobody's hired us. And we hear that, we go, oh no, they're just a bunch of lazy bums. And I'm thinking, you have never been to Home Depot in Southern California, where you have Latino men who are day laborers,
right,
who are looking for work. And until somebody comes along in a pickup truck and says, I want you, you, and you, they don't get work. So this guy is hiring day laborers. And then 1 hour later, right, he starts paying them their wage. And the last group that worked for 1 hour gets the normal day's wage. And then the first group is playing the comparison game, right? And when they get a normal day's wage, they grumble, which is what ancient Israel did in the wilderness.
Mm.
And Jesus says, literally, he says, is your eye evil because I'm good? And so some people say this parable illustrates the generosity of the master. And I say, it's not generosity, it's grace. There's a big difference. What you get has nothing to do with how long you worked.
Yeah.
We hate that.
It's not exactly capitalism.
Well, it's not. And it's not socialism either.
Right? Imagine.
No, it's not. Right. And so you just have to keep your eye on the master. Oh, maybe that's the point. But you see how unexpected that story is?
Right.
And it illustrates the graciousness of Jesus.
Yeah.
In a way that just makes us crazy until the Holy Spirit can open our hearts to say, oh, this is good. This is right.
So perspective, because I always have to take things that I learned here and then put it in terms that I can understand and then hopefully teach to somebody one day. Another class I took at Westfield House was Christianity in Late Antiquity, which actually just means a long time ago. And we were talking about Constantine, and there's always this question, was Constantine a Christian?
Uh-huh.
And was he baptized on his deathbed? Was he converted at the last moment? So was he really a Christian? It's like, well, if he was, as in if he was baptized and converted a second before he died, guess what? His seat in heaven is next to yours.
Right.
The person who was baptized as a baby.
Right.
And we'll say I was a lifelong Christian and, you know, obeyed all the laws of God, but in reality, you know, you sinned just like Constantine did.
Right.
Which I think, if I'm understanding the parable correctly,
yes,
is the point.
That is central to the parable, right. I had here's a story from the years in Oregon. It was the brother-in-law who was a Lutheran pastor. A man was converted and baptized at age 57. Okay, his wife was a faithful Christian her whole life, and she prayed for her husband. And finally, this man, through his brother-in-law's witness to him, was converted. And this couple and another older couple came to our congregation, and they joined the congregation. So at age 57, see. At age 59, this man, who had become a Christian only 2 years before, was facing heart surgery, right? And I was his pastor, and I went to see him in the hospital pre-op, you know, before the surgery. And I asked him how he's doing. He says, I'm just so troubled. I'm so upset. I said, well, why? And he said, because I wasted my whole life. And he had had what American might call, especially kind of hard-living Americans, he had had the good life, and then he got to be a Christian too. But his perspective was that for 57 years, he had wasted his life. Wow. And what a tragedy that was. And I assured him, it seemed to work, that God shows no partiality, right? And there is no distinction, and his baptism into Christ was as powerful and wonderful as mine was, and I was baptized as an infant, see? Mm-hmm. So I visited him that night. He died in surgery the next day.
Wow.
So right next to Constantine,
right,
and the thief on the cross is my friend and brother, Robert Bond.
Look at that.
That was his name. And and if we struggle with that, it means on some level we're struggling with grace.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, that's the unregenerate man, right?
Exactly.
I want to be able to do by myself.
Yeah, that's
and,
right.
And,
that's
and right. I should be able to do it by myself, right?
Right.
And
right.
It only in this economy of God can I even begin to approach the idea that I can't.
Right, right. And we have to keep getting used to the idea over and over again.
Every day.
You learn it once and then you're a Christian, right? Maybe you learn it as a young child, but then you have to keep learning it over and over again. Yeah. I had a very honest member back then. She used to say, "Pastor, I hate that parable." I thought, well, Linda, bless your heart. You know, that's what they would say in the South.
Yeah,
bless your heart.
Bless your little heart. Yeah.
There are several, so we're blessed as pastors, right? If you follow a lectionary series, that you get three readings and there are parables that come up, and I'll look at the Old Testament and epistle.
Yeah.
And they might not be very preachable texts. And texts that naturally lend themselves to the preaching task.
Yes.
And I'll still pick them over the parable just because I'm going to force something and maybe make a few things up here or there.
Yeah.
Or just preach on it something else, or like bring up the text and then actually preach a different text.
Right.
That isn't this parable, just because of this. Some of them, like the parable of the sower, ones we're familiar, parable of the Good Samaritan, even the one with the weeds and the wheat where the enemy comes, like they lend themselves to the task.
Yes.
But some of them.
No, they can be very challenging.
Yeah.
Right. And it's more of a Bible class where you can talk about it and people can ask questions, right?
And then if you're me, say, well, I don't know. Let me try to look it up.
Yeah.
But not actually go look it up. Just say that to get out of the question.
You can always say, let me get back to you on that one.
Yeah.
And then you can do some research or just hope they forget.
Right.
Yeah. But then you get the people in Bible class that
never forget.
The next week, they're, of Pastor, did you do your homework?
They want to know.
Oh, of course they do.
Yeah. I had a lovely conversation with a deaconess a few months ago about life issues. And it's funny. I can't remember half of what I say anyway, right? But former students will say, oh, yeah, I remember when you in class you said, and I cringe because, A, I hope it's not terrible, and, B, I hope I remember saying it. You know? But she actually said, because she was in the deaconess program, and she said, you told us we should buy big books. Mm. And that's right, because you need resources, because pastors need to learn, you know, our listeners are thinking, oh, I don't know as much as I would know if I were a pastor. Well, that might be true. But guess what? Pastors don't know as much yet as they will.
Right.
And I was just reading Luke 22 this afternoon a little bit. I'm thinking, man, this is great. I didn't know all this was in there. Well, so it's really, the Bible in that sense is a very exciting book.
And for each one of us, I mean, the amount, I feel, so since graduating seminary, people always, because this is a question that people ask, because they're coming from the workforce sometimes and they say, well, how much can I work while I'm a seminary student? I always try to be explicit and I say, not much.
Yeah.
And I try to scale it for them. And to this day, because some of them think they can work full time, I've never met somebody who's worked full time and been a full time student here successfully at either.
Right.
But after leaving, I feel like I study as much, if not more, than I did when I was a student here. The task again, trying to learn it all. I mean, it's just like you said, lifelong discipleship,
right?
Because there's always going to be something different, something new.
Yeah,
that you find something, because again, when you're preaching, you're looking for something specific to what you want to say on that Sunday,
right?
Even if we say we let the text speak to us.
Yep.
If we're honest.
And what's cool is that kind of learning is situated in a particular context, a relationship you have with somebody, if you're their pastor,
right?
Or if you have a friend who has a question, and see, that's a motivational thing. Wait. Oh, I don't really know the best way to respond here biblically to this important person for whom Jesus died and rose from the dead, right? And so that motivates me in a way that, you know how it is when you're sitting in a classroom. Well, of course, in all of my classrooms, everybody always paid attention and nobody was ever bored.
Perfect.
But I hear that in other seminary classrooms, sometimes they don't. But you know how it is in a classroom. It's kind of theoretical, which is good, right?
Right.
But if you're in a neighborhood or in a congregation or in a job, and this kind of stuff comes up, then you're motivated to say, hey, where can I learn more? Ask your pastor, what do I do with this? And it's really, in that sense, it's great.
Yep. And then some texts will speak louder.
Yes.
Before we're blessed, right? Most of us, we have our favorite English translation, the standard one, I think, for us synodically, as at the moment, ESV.
Right.
But that wasn't always the case. And so they go through, and what people may or may not realize is that translators are making translation moves for us, so that you can approach the test, and in particular with headings.
Right.
And so a lot of times they'll say the parable of the sower. So before you read it, you know you're about to read a parable.
Right.
But not only is this not only the case, but sometimes because there is a certain ring, there's a way a parable could get started when you know you're getting into a parable,
right,
even without the header. But sometimes, not so much, at least in my experience, mm-hmm, ignoring headers and or reading a non-English Bible. What are those markers that you know? Like, so Nathan, again, well, I might be speaking in a turn. I don't think he says, I'm about to tell you a parable.
No,
David,
no, not
here's
at
a parable.
No,
he starts saying it.
He tells
it
as if it were a historical event.
Exactly.
Right?
But it ends up being a parable. How do we know, or what are some markers that we know where we're actually reading a parable?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Because a fair amount of the time Jesus does, or if he doesn't say, this is a parable, the evangelist, the gospel writer, does.
Right.
Jesus told him another parable, mm-hmm, saying, right? And so there you're on clear ground. But for an example, the parable of the sower is not given that kind of an introduction. And so only you read it, and then Jesus, they say, why do you teach them in parables? And then you get the interpretation, you go, you might have to go back and say, that was a parable.
See? Right.
And there's one instance of this in Luke, actually, where it's the parable, and I do think it is a parable, of the rich man and Lazarus,
mm,
right?
Yep.
And that's not introduced as a parable. And some people have argued, friends of mine actually have argued, that it's not a parable, that it's actually a literal teaching about dying and going to heaven, right? Which is what the parable is about, if it is a parable. But see, there's one where you kind of have to look in Luke 16 and look around, and what you find, if you look around, is that earlier in that chapter, there is the parable of the unjust steward, which is one of those ones where you probably want to preach on the Old Testament or the epistle lesson because it's so difficult.
People have explained it to me. I still don't. I'm not sure.
No, that's a challenging. That's the most challenging parable, in my opinion. But see, it begins exactly the way the rich man. There was a rich man.
Mm-hmm.
And then later in the chapter, there was a rich man. Okay. Mm-hmm. So again, if these questions get us to read the Bible more carefully,
right?
That's a good thing. So that's actually one example where there is a debate. At least something of a debate. I think most people do regard the rich man and Lazarus as a parable there at the end of Luke 16. But sometimes you just have to look carefully and study. And isn't that cool? Sometimes they sneak up on you.
Right.
If you've never read it before and you think, what is this story about a farmer doing in here?
Right.
You know? And then you think, it's a parable. And then you go back and you know, it's snuck up on you. Snuck, I think that's a word. Yeah.
Well, I want to maybe kind of round out our time by asking, you know, our listeners are primarily, our target audience are thinking about seminary. They're
right.
Thinking about maybe this is for them, but they're kind of in that discerning mode. We meet with these people all the time. They
yes.
come here to visit, or we meet them at a pre-seminary thing at one of our Concordias. And they're just wrestling with, should I come to seminary? Should I not? You dealt with a lot of seminarians over lots of years. What encouragement would you have, either with the parables or just in general, what encouragement would you give people who are thinking about possibly coming to study at Concordia Seminary to be a pastor or to be a deaconess or to be
right.
a teacher?
Right, right. That's a good question, Ben. I was going to answer it by telling a parable, but then I couldn't think of one. So
that would have been really good.
I'll say one thing. If your only motivation for asking that question is that you should, then you probably shouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
See, because that sounds too much like guilt or obligation. I think the ministry, whether it's ordained pastoral ministry or the service of deaconesses or other church workers, I don't think it can be motivated primarily by I should.
Mm.
That's, I think, a bad idea. But if it kind of excites you, then you should keep gathering information and you should talk to people that you trust. including people who are willing to look you in the eyeball and tell you yes if you don't want them to, or tell you no if you don't want them to. Mm-hmm. So honest people around you that you trust. Now, this shows you the high level of my intelligence. When I was 19 years old, I thought about being a pastor. I thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to have to talk to people. Because I had to learn how to be a public extrovert. I really did, you know. So, but the answer is, well, you can learn how to do that, you know. So really, don't do it just out of obligation. If you're interested, get information and talk to people you trust. Here's the most important one. That is, are you just really grateful that Jesus is for you? See? Yeah. And if you are, and you know that you belong to him, when you were baptized, you were claimed by Jesus. You belong to him. And he wants you to serve him somehow, right? So if that good news is a vibrant and meaningful to you, then check it out, right? And I'm looking at two guys that can answer questions and help people to check it out.
For the most part, even with that, sometimes I have to let me get back to you. But
that's right.
It's honest. It's honest work. I'll say that.
It is indeed. Yeah. It is indeed. Yeah. So I don't know if that makes sense.
Thank you. That's fantastic. This has been a fantastic conversation. I would tell our listeners that if you don't already, find Jeff Gibbs on Facebook, because you're in for a laugh. You're in for a parable every once in a while, something that sneaks up on you, public service announcement. And there will be lessons on grammar. There will be lessons on how to use I or me. Or not use those. So it's always a kick. I love how active you are on Facebook and just zinging out wisdom for people.
If you're looking for the name of your band, that's really what you want to get on Facebook
right.
with Jeff Gibbs for.
Yeah.
He's got a good band name for you, I guarantee.
Like we had a problem with feral cats in our neighborhood, and we live in that part of town called Dogtown, so I thought Feral Cats of Dogtown would be a great name for a band. But I will say this, Ben, now that you've hoisted me out there in public, I will not friend anybody that I don't know personally.
Oh, same.
That's good.
Yeah. And that doesn't mean I don't like you. It just means I don't know you.
Right.
And, but people can still follow you even if...
yeah, sure. Okay. Right. See, I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
Right. So Facebook is... to all of our listeners out there, don't try to talk about anything complicated on Facebook with somebody else. It's good for sharing simple joys, simple sorrows, and telling stupid jokes.
Yeah.
And I major in that last category.
Yeah, I appreciate the good jokes. I'll build you up a little bit.
Okay, good.
Well, everybody, this again is another episode of Under the Fig Tree. We thank you all for joining us. This is part one of a series. We'll be talking about more parables. We mentioned some that we'll be bringing up, and we'll be trying to dive deep into them, including the one of the unjust guy,
the unjust manager.
There we go.
Your
Bible probably calls him something else, but nonetheless, we're going to try to dive deep into it, and we brought somebody smarter than at least me to help us with that. And so once again, Under the Fig Tree with me, Reverend Mikey Glenn, and Dr. Ben Haupt. Thank you for joining us, and we will see you next time.